rare privilege of following a sample of teen mothers and their families for 21 years now. And so it's a qualitative study now with three generations, so just imagine the buckets and buckets and buckets of data I have. So today I'm just giving you a really tiny slice. I have no relationships to disclose. Beginning in the 1980s, when teen mothering emerged as a public health and a political issue, clinical and policy discourse has pretty much and continues to emphasize the poor short and long-term outcomes for teen mothers and their children. And these poor outcomes are pretty much attributed to young maternal age. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to describe the state of the science studies that really challenge this connection. But what I can say is there's been a lot of limitations to this research. Use of inadequate comparison groups, failure to control for selectivity into teen mothering, very few longitudinal studies, mine's one of them, and even fewer studies that examine how teen mothers' lives and outcomes are situated in larger systems, including the family system. So what do we know about families and teen mothers? Well, we know that grandparents figure very prominently in the lives of teen mothers and their children, especially in the first few years postpartum. They offer a great deal of support, but there can also be a great source of, grandparents can be a great source of conflict, particularly because co-residence is very common, particularly after TANF was initiated in 1996. And so that can make it very difficult for parents to and grandparents to negotiate parenting. What we know very little about is how family processes and relationships shape outcomes for teen mothers, their children, and other family members, especially after the first few years postpartum, and how those processes and relationships evolve over time. So for all of you who are doing your dissertation work, the very first study was my dissertation study. I had no idea I was going to continue to follow these families, but, you know, it happened. Because there was just so much I was learning from the families. I've followed them pretty much every 4 to 5 years, and the last follow-up, the sixth wave of the study, was in 2010. The original study aims were to describe the teen mother's aspirations, concerns, challenges, and practices at the end of the first postpartum year. And because I was a practicing public health nurse, and I knew how important grandparents were in the lives of teen mothers and their children, so I wanted to describe how grandparents were involved, and also to describe how their practices and involvement shaped the teen mother's concerns, challenges, and practices. So I knew it was a very mutual, interactive, circular kind of thing. So today's paper, I'm really focusing on how a subset that I'll describe later of family caregiving practices unfolded over time, over 2 decades, and how they shaped the teen mother's long-term outcomes. The study's qualitative, and I'm an interpretive phenomenologist, and interpretive phenomenology has these assumptions that human lives and actions are always situated and developed in dialogue, that shared meanings are expressed in families' everyday practices, and that they can be revealed. So let me tell you a little bit about the very first study. To be included in the study, the teen had to be a first-time mother who had given birth to a healthy newborn 8 to 10 months earlier. So I was interviewing them near the end of the first postpartum year. They had to be non-Latina, white, or African-American, and the teen's parent or surrogate parent had to be willing to participate for the teen mother to be included in the study. And partners of the teen mothers were invited with the mother's permission. I didn't have very many of those. So at the very beginning, I had 16 families and all these family members. I did lose some of those families at the last wave, but you can see that the sample size went up because at time 4, I began interviewing the firstborn child of the teen mother when they were about 12 to 13 years of age. And in the last follow-up, I included any child over the age of 12. So that's how I get to a sample size of 46. Of course, I've had a couple grandparents who have died as well. So the data collection at time one was very intense. There were three interview sessions with the teen and her partner, if he was involved, over a 3 to 5 month period. Three interviews with the grandparents, separate. These were all separate interviews. But then I did a joint interview with the teen and the grandparent. And then I hung out with the families 4 to 6 hours over a 3 month period, just hanging out with them to see how, you know, what I was learning from the interviews, how were indeed the grandparents and the other family members involved in the care of the baby. It was much less, the data collection was much less intense at the subsequent waves, but there were always two sessions with the mother and or her partner a month apart. There was one session with the grandparent, and then beginning at the fourth wave, there's always been one session with the child or children, unless that child became a parent, and then I had two sessions with those who became parents. So at time six, the teens were 35 to 50 years of age, 7 were white, 4 were African American, but look at the diversity in income, right? This was a very diverse socioeconomic sample from the very beginning. I had very poor teen mothers, and I also had pretty middle income teen families and their marital status there. Firstborn children now were 20 to 22 years of age. And you can also see great diversity in terms of their educational attainment and their current status if they were working. I've had several who have graduated from college. Some are in graduate school now. What I did to strengthen the rigor of the study, interviews were always transcribed verbatim and corrected before the next visits. As I coded the data, then I created what are called interpretive profiles for each family, for each wave of the study. That was really crucial so I could then compare all the interpretive profiles as I was trying to make sense of, you know, cross comparisons with families, but then over time. So those were really crucial. And they included coded data, interpretive insights, and my changes in understanding. And I always had other researchers who read at least some of the data and talked with me about my interpretations. So what's really, I need to set the stage here because what happened to some of the families who were in the pattern of adversarial caregiving. But most of the families fit these two patterns I identified at time one. Most of the families fit within the pattern I identified as responsive caregiving. And in this pattern, the grandparents leap ahead to foster the teen's care of the baby. So they were really very supportive of the teen's capabilities. They approached conflicts over the care of the baby through dialogue, and they shared the care of the baby with a lot of flexibility. Now, sometimes they might go off in a little bit of a wrong direction, but they could pull themselves back and know that their real concern was the teen mother be a good mother. Adversarial caregiving was a totally different situation. There were two forms of adversarial caregiving. In the first form, grandparents just leapt right in and took over the care of the baby. Or another pattern was to sit back and become a very critical bystander. But both of those forms were really very adversarial because there were intense conflicts over the infant care. And teens in both those situations really had to struggle to gain confidence and to be recognized as a mother because they were pretty much told all the time what a terrible parent they were. So what I'm doing today is I'm going to present three cases who were very strong examples of adversarial caregiving at time one and show you what happened over the 21 years. The first two cases highlight the landmines, power struggles, and poor outcomes associated with adversarial practices over 21 years. But the third case demonstrates how relationships are difficult but not impossible to repair. So the first case, Anne was the teen mother. She was the third child and only daughter of Rob and Joan. I'm going to refer to them as grandparents. They themselves had very difficult childhoods and a very tumultuous marriage. And in fact, they were separated at the time that Anne's pregnancy was confirmed. And guess what? They reunited at that point, And as soon as Drew was born, they just leapt right in because guess what? It saved their marriage. And in fact, they stayed, they never separated again. But they did this at the expense of Anne. So Anne is really sidelined from the very beginning. Now, Joan just lays it all out how this happens. She says, this is the grandma, if you've got a brand new mother, sometimes she can really easily feel pushed aside and taken over. And when you're the new grandma, you can just as easily slide in there and take over without realizing what you're doing. Every time he'd cry, every time he needed to be changed, anything to do with holding him, I was right there. It was just like he was mine. So Joan and Rob totally usurp parenting. And Anne withdraws and becomes increasingly rebellious and resentful. She never gains confidence as a mother because, of course, Drew's participating in this too, right? Drew's now is looking always to Joan and Rob. And Anne is always chastised for being unfit. And, of course, she's becoming more resentful and she's out past curfew, blah, blah, blah. And Joan and Rob repeatedly request custody, which she refused. So over the next several years, Anne goes on to have two additional children. You can see their ages at time six. And she eventually relinquished her sons, the two oldest. But she says, I didn't want to do it. I was just messed up mentally, physically, emotionally, all the way through. I felt useless, horrible. She also married and divorced twice. And Anne and her third child, Liddy, was abused in the first marriage. Anne lives on and off with Joan and her two sons, especially when her marriages or relationships with partners soured. So in this family, there's just really marked by ambiguous generational boundaries. From the start, Anne is told she's unfit. Now, this just kind of threw me for a loop. Because Anne's sons, even though they had lived with her, at least the oldest child when he was a little bit older, till age five, they were told that Anne was their adoptive sister, not their biological mother. It was really hard for me in an interview, how do I refer to these family members when I'm talking to each? Do I call Anne's sons her, her brother? I was like, oh my God. So, but the fact is, Anne doesn't know where she fits in, and she's very enmeshed with Libby and can't protect her, who does indeed become pregnant at age 15. So there's a long shadow of leaping in and taking over, multiple losses, ambiguous generational boundaries. For Anne, a very poor work history, depression, substance abuse, violence. She's very dependent on Joan or unreliable men, so she gets herself in a lot of scrapes. Sons, who have pretty much lived with Joan and Rob eventually died, they didn't graduate high school. They eventually got their GEDs, but they have a pretty poor work history. And this is Anne's existential situation at time six. I was a teen parent, and my mother took my boys like double due. That kind of made me think twice about myself. It's like, am I a parent or am I not a parent? Am I somebody? Am I important? It's like I'm climbing up a broken ladder. You're lost, empty, and no power to yourself. Okay, the second case is the second form of adversarial caregiving. Meg is a teen mom, and she was Carol's youngest child. Carol, the grandparent, was a single mom who herself was abused as a child. Meg had her first son, Mike, at age 17, and things went pretty well for them as long as Meg followed Carol's directions. And in fact, Meg says about her mom, she was a lifesaver. But then as Meg started showing more independence, Carol became much more critical and struggled to not take over. And in fact, she became unemployed at 11 months of age for Mike. And she left the home every day because she was so afraid she was going to take over. And there's just intense family conflict. So Meg says to me in those first interviews, I can't do anything right. And Carol says, you're either an active participant or you're a bystander, and you're going to go nuts watching this whole transaction go on. And, oh, as I mentioned, Carol deliberately stays away from home and refuses to help for fear she will take over. So this is that second form where you become a really critical bystander. Over time, Meg had three additional sons with two different men, she got involved with abusive partners. She lived almost all the time with Carol. Carol spoils and rescues her oldest, intense sibling rivalry, and lots of patterns of withdrawal, domination. And in fact, at time five, Mike says, there's a black cloud hanging over this family. In fact, Carol's holding the household together. She's cooking the meals, she's paying the bills, until she thinks, oh, I can't do this forever. So she retreats to her bedroom, and this is when she notices, I keep wondering if I'm part of the problem. Maybe I've done so much that I've rendered Meg totally inept. At time six, I learn that they separated 4 years earlier. And so the long shadow under bad circumstances, so the long shadow for this family, Meg has a very poor work history, unstable housing, she's on disability and in poor health, socially isolated and depressed. She's very dependent on Carol, but Carol restricts any involvement. Mike completed his GED, but he's refusing all contact with his mom. Zach, the second child, is very angry and truant. Carol expects to retire, and what she tells me is she's going to limit Meg to one phone call a week. She says, I'm learning how to not be involved in everybody's life. And Meg at time six, as much as I try to fight it, I'm a lot like my mom. I'm not as mentally involved as I could be with my kids. She wasn't mentally or physically there for us. So the third case is a wonderful case of how a family really repairs their relationships, and it makes a dramatic both the kids, the teen mom and the child do very, very well. Jill gave birth to Dawn at age 15. Sally and Ed, though, were very permissive parents. And when they began to set rules for Jill, Jill said that was too late because she was rebelling. And so Sally and Ed ended up raising Dawn till about age 3. But there were like intense family conflicts. Like World War III. But by time two, this sort of fortuitous thing happens. Sally and Ed move dramatically about 400 miles away. And they want to take Dawn with them, but Jill is adamant that Dawn will remain with her, so they move in with Jill's boyfriend. And they renegotiate family relationships. Sally, the grandmother, says how hard it was. I was jealous. I was feeling sorry for myself, and I tried to make everybody feel guilty, but then I realized it wasn't helping Dawn, and I think that probably the best thing was that we did move away. And she says, I'm feeling more like a grandmother than a mother now. Dawn now looks to her mother as mommy. I'm not going to do this one because I'm running out of time, but the important thing is that they succeed at renegotiating their relationships and practices. And Jill says at time two, I actually feel close to my parents now in a different way and not like a threatening manner with them trying to rule my life. 2 decades later, Jill is married, not to the father of her firstborn, and she's had a second child. She's always worked part-time. She's close to her parents. Dawn's close to Jill, her stepdad, and her grandparents, graduated from college in a long-term relationship. Jill's only regret is that I missed out a lot on Dawn's raising. So, I mean, in this very small sample, with these extreme cases that I have, very early over or under involvement by grandparents provides a very precarious ground for mothering unless relationships are repaired. You can see both Anne and Meg, damaged sense of self, depression, abusive, unstable housing, poor work histories, and impaired relationships. And, of course, the grandparents and the children also suffer. But when relationships can be repaired, Jill reset her course. And the gains that she makes as a mother are then extended to other life domains in work, marriage, supportive family relationships. And Dawn made a very smooth transition to early adulthood compared to the other two families. So implications for practice. Identify red flags for adversarial caregiving. And always avoid triangulating with the teen mother or the grandparent. That's bad. And I had, they told me about that. Red flags: grandparents report over or under involvement, intense power struggles, they describe their teen as an unfit parent, or the teen mother reports that she feels excluded, criticized, she shows few gains in maternal confidence, and she says they're doing too much or too little. These are just two really productive questions you can ask the teen mother to see where the grandparents are fitting in. And just in conclusion, you know, we really need to look at family caregiving practices in terms of long-term outcomes for teen mothers and their children, because they're highly interrelated. And long-term co-residence, too, is probably a red flag. It may also reflect and reinforce impaired relationships and power struggles. And I just want to thank all the families and my co-author, Vicki Leonard, who's here, and my mentors. Thank you.